Okay, boys and girls, ladies and gentlemen, everyone knows that that sound means it's time again for another installation of Moi. As you might have guessed from the preceding little guitar intro from one of my favorite bands, we're going to be talking about tonight addictions. And actually, this is going to be the first in a several-part series, since this is going to be a pretty meaty little discussion that's going to cover a lot of ground. I thought I'd break it up into several different sections so that I wasn't spending huge amounts of time talking about this one particular aspect of functioning here. As some of you may or may not know, the common layperson's term of addiction is more formally known in the substance abuse profession as dependency, but dependency is only one of several disorders that fall under the group of disorders in general, called substance-related disorders, and in particular, we're going to be talking about substance use disorders, typically known as SUDs in my profession. And that includes both dependency, aka addiction, and abuse, which are two related but different patterns. Since most of you probably don't know the criteria between the two, I think it's kind of important for me to sort of lay the groundwork for that. Because those are two very different phenomena, and the current version of the DSM, which is the DSM-4, is very, very different from the criteria in the DSM-3, which was the previous version, which originally came out in 1980 and then revised, I think, in 87, the DSM-3R. But at any rate, this particular criteria, which we're using since 1994, and then 2000, the DSM-4-TR came out, which is a slightly revised edition, but still the same basic stuff here. And basically, to diagnose someone with a substance abuse problem requires a lot less data and criteria, if you will, than substance dependence. Of course, then we run into the issue of, well, what's the difference in substance abuse and substance use? Because obviously those are also kind of related phenomena. And what I talk about with most of my folks when I'm trying to give them sort of a quick and dirty heads up is that, you know, most of us from time to time are substance users. You know, we might have a drink at a party, a social gathering, or we might have a glass of wine with dinner. Or for those of you who do other sorts of things, you might involve other sorts of substances that you're imbibing. I also want to make a differentiation here that and definition scenario, because really, when you talk about drugs, quote-unquote, substances, whatever, according to pharmacological principles of the body, anything you put into your mouth, in a sense, that gets chemically decomposed to be used as some sort of nutritional substance for your body, whether it's water or cheesecake or, Coca-Cola, so to speak, or other types of Coke, or alcohol, or whatever. All of those are technically defined as a drug, quote unquote. So what we're really talking about are substances / drugs, if you will, that are beneficial for us versus those that are not. Certainly, all of the medically prescribed drugs that are taken appropriately are obviously, quote unquote, drugs. And those are no more or less different from the recreational substances we take, except that they're usually engineered to hit certain brain sites in certain dosages and not just sort of play helter-skelter with our body and brain as the more street available versions of those drugs and varieties are. But be that as it may, when I use the term drug, I'm really going to be talking about things that are not necessarily required by the body that we do in excess of those quantities which are good for us, or do it when we don't really have some sort of condition that requires us to do it. For example, you know, certain drugs are good for certain people but may not be good for other folks. For example, and I often use this with my folks, you know, penicillin is a great drug if you have, you know, a certain kind of infection, and it's a great antibiotic unless you happen to have an allergy to it like I do. So, you know, when I take penicillin, I get visual and auditory hallucinations, which are not very appealing. And I had that unfortunate experience at a very, very young age. And ever since then, I've just never had a liking for any sorts of hallucinogenic types of things. You know, I wonder why. You know, but I tell everybody, penicillin is a great drug if you're not allergic to it and if you need it. You know, if you have a venereal disease or you know, some sort of bacterial infection that requires, you know, that sort of drug. It's a great drug, but I can't take it because it doesn't do anything for me except geek me out. And don't really like that feeling, being the kind of internally motivated control freak that I am, as most of you know who know me. Don't like to be out of control, so that's penicillin for me is bad, okay, to quote Mr. Mackey in South Park. So, you know, penicillin's a great drug, it's just not good for me. Same thing with sulfa drugs. Sulfa drugs are great drugs, but I also have an allergy to those as well. So that sort of relegates me to the mycin category, you know. But again, you know, we're talking about somebody who has a weird condition for that. Same thing with drugs like methylphenidate, more commonly known to most of you out there probably as Ritalin, which is the most typical psychostimulant slash sympathomimetic medication, so-called because it mimics the sympathetic or fight-or-flight nervous system, sympathomimetic. See how easy these terms are? They're really not that difficult. They just sound important when people like me use them and say it kind of fast, sympathomimetic, and everybody goes, "Woo, he's really smart." No, not really. But again, if you have a really nasty case of ADHD and you don't have an allergy to these drugs and you really need them, and you give somebody a reasonable dose of methylphenidate, you know, it can work wonders for folks that need that drug. However, other folks can take the same drug, crush it into, if it's in a certain form, crush it down into a powder and snort it like cocaine because it is an amphetamine-like substance. And for them, that's not a good drug because it makes them high. So obviously that's not something that their body needs. They're using it in excess of what their body needs or requires. So again, that for me is sort of the cutting edge factor. You know, is the drug required by the body, or are you using it for some sort of external recreational, hedonistic, and or abusive, quote unquote, properties that you really shouldn't be using it for? So, but to get back to the abuse versus use, you know, to me, you can use a drug even recreationally like alcohol, as I think most of us probably do, and certainly I have done that from time to time, although, you know, like the typical nerd that I am, never having been drunk, obviously I haven't abused it. And there goes the difference between use and abuse, you know, and then you talk about, okay, well then do you have a chronic pattern of abuse? You know, do you abuse the drug fairly frequently, or do you abuse it in situations where you're not in control and now, you know, you sort of like quote-unquote need it, you've developed what's called a tolerance to the drug. You're starting to, you know, move into the slippery slope between abuse and dependence. But let me just talk about the criteria for substance abuse, because really probably most of you listeners out there could qualify for a substance abuse disorder under the DSM, and you don't even know it, because here's the basic line. Substance abuse in the DSM, current DSM, is defined as a maladaptive pattern of use that leads to either a significant impairment or significant distress, and you only need that to be manifested in one or more, obviously, of the following indices that occur within a 12-month period. And I'm going to read them out to you. This is directly from the DSM. So recurrent use of a substance, I'm paraphrasing, that results in some kind of failure to fulfill a major role obligation at work or at school or at home. So, for example, you have repeated absences at work, your work at school is substandard, you're sort of, you know, getting expelled from school because you're getting caught with drugs on your possession or you're coming intoxicated, that kind of thing. That's criteria one. Criteria two, recurrent substance use in situations in which it is physically hazardous. In other words, you're driving a car under the influence or operating some kind of farm machinery that could, you know, take your arm off kind of thing under the influence. Criteria three, recurrent substance-related legal problems. So you got arrested for DUI, or you got disorderly conduct because you were under the influence, you got in a fight at a bar, or you got in a fight at a football game at a school. Okay. Or criteria number four, you continue to use the substance despite having problems that are recurrent and persistent in your social situation or interpersonal situation, or the situational problems you're having are grossly exacerbated or made worse by the effects of using the substance. So you're getting into physical fights with friends, you're getting into seriously heated arguments with some loved one, spouse, boyfriend, girlfriend, whatever, because they're pissed off that you use drugs, basically, and they're fussing at you, and you guys get into this big dilly. So notice that you only need one of those four on a recurrent basis, because notice it says recurrent or continued. You can't do it one time, right? And you could qualify for a substance abuse disorder. And all of these, by the way, are substance specific, which means you can have a substance abuse disorder with alcohol, but not with, let's say, cocaine or marijuana or whatever, right? So they're all substance specific. Now that's very, very different from substance dependence, right? Which is the same story. It's a maladaptive pattern of using a substance that leads to a significant distress or impairment. But in this case, you have to have three or more of the following criteria that I'm going to call out in the same 12-month period. So criteria number one is tolerance. And most of you know what that is. That means you need more of the drug to have the same effect that you did with a less amount of the drug just a little while ago. So you have to increase the substance to get the same effect, or you get a diminished effect with using the same substance. So that's tolerance. That's criteria one. Criteria two is withdrawal. So basically that means your body's bit-smacking you when you're not taking it, okay? So you're having some sort of syndrome, symptom of behaviors that are usually drug-specific. That's caused by you're not taking the drug or taking the drug in less degrees than you did, or you have to take the drug to avoid getting this withdrawal symptom. Okay, so that's criteria two. Criteria three, the substance is often taken in more dosages or over a longer time period than you initially intended to do it. So you said, okay, I'm only going to have three beers tonight, and you end up having 10 beers, and it's something that you do more than once or twice. Criteria number four, you have a persistent desire to use the drug, or you have unsuccessful attempts at trying to curtail your drug use, cut down on it, or stop using it. Or control it in somehow. So you promise yourself you're not going to use it for a week and you do it the very next day kind of thing. Okay? That's criteria number four. Criteria number five, there's a great deal of time spent in activities needed to get the substance. So you're going to various doctors shopping for iatrogenic substances. Oh, sorry guys, that's from the Greek iatros, which means physician. So iatrogenic just means prescribed prescription drugs. Okay. See, you think I'm all smart, and I'm really not. And because I cheat, because my mom's Greek, so I have the advantage of having a little history there. At any rate, so you're going to different doctors, doctor shopping, getting different drugs from different physicians, right? Or you're driving really long distances to get to drug, you know, illicit drug dealers to buy pot or whatever. Or you're having a great deal of time recovering from the use of the effects. Okay, so you're spending a whole lot of time using the substance, trying to get the substance, or recovering from the effects of the substance. That's criteria number five. Criteria number six is important occupational stuff, recreational activities, or social events that are either minimized, reduced, or just completely given up because you're basically too drunk or stoned or incapacitated to go to them. You're too busy getting high than you are going to, you know, your friend's birthday party or whatever. And criteria number seven is you're using the drug despite the fact you know it's messing with you. You know it's causing you psychological problems. You know it's causing you recurrent physical problems. And if you have a condition, a physical condition, and you're, you know, taking the drug, it's making the condition worse kind of thing, and you know it, but you just keep doing it anyway. Okay? So all of those seven criteria, you only need three of those to be diagnosed as being substance dependent, quote unquote, addicted, and they have to occur in the same 12-month period. As most of you know, you may or may not have dependence on a drug, physiological dependence on a drug. So some drugs don't have necessarily a physical dependence syndrome, but they have a psychological dependence. Most drugs have psychological dependence. In fact, I would argue all drugs have a psychological dependence. And that really is the thing that keeps people unsuccessful in their attempts to stop using drugs when they're, quote unquote, in recovery or attempting to try to get over drugs. It's really the psychological stuff, because for all intents and purposes, the drug is out of your body physically enough after about a three-week period, that even if you're uber physically addicted, you're going to be over it in about a three-week period. Enough of the drug is going to be out of your system that you're not going to have withdrawal symptoms. You're not going to have the delirium tremens, or you're not going to have these shakes or any kind of weird, crazy stuff associated with the drug. So what causes people to relapse is not the physical dependency, but the psychological dependency, which is manifested in a number of ways and caused by a number of factors, part of it being the association thing. You know, it's like people trying to quit cigarettes and trying to quit drinking. Most studies will tell you that if you're going to be successful, you do both at the same time. You don't stop one and then the other. Even though a lot of the folks that I work with that have substance use disorder problems, addiction problems, dependency issues, will like start balking, "Oh my God, you're not going to ask me to quit using both of those drugs at the same time, are you?" Well, why, yes I am, and thanks for asking. And then they get all flustered, "Oh my God," and you know, and as any good substance addict can tell you, the most dangerous drug in America in terms of death quotient, and one of the hardest drugs to quit using also, by the way, for a number of reasons, is not cocaine. It's not heroin. It's not methamphetamine. Do we know what that drug is, boys and girls, ladies and gentlemen? Do 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 do. Yeah, that's Final Jeopardy. And the answer is cigarettes, nicotine. Cigarettes kill more people every year than three times the number of people that are killed with all of the drugs combined, okay? And I mean, when I say the term drug, by the way, I mean alcohol. I don't separate alcohol out. So you won't hear me say alcohol and other drugs. You'll hear a lot of clinicians use that term. I just use drugs because they're all drugs, okay? It's not a difference. Alcohol is a drug just like cigarettes are a drug, just like caffeine is a drug, and theophylline, which is the caffeine derivative in tea, iced tea or hot tea. You know, they're all drugs, so I won't partial them out. So cigarettes kill the number of people every year greater than three times the number of all other drugs added together, including alcohol, okay? So I always tell parents when they bring their teenage son or daughter in and, you know, complain that their daughter's, you know, smoking pot or addicted to alcohol or using meth or whatever, and, you know, and certainly I'm not, you know, justifying any of that stuff, so please don't mishear me. But if the parent walks in, one of the first things I ask the parent is, are you a cigarette smoker? And they'll go, yes. I'm like, well, I'm sorry, you're a drug addict too. Okay, so you can't be telling your kid not to use drugs. You're a hypocrite. Sorry, don't mean to be rude, but that's hypocritical behavior, right? I don't smoke cigarettes. I'm allergic to them, actually. Right, a musician who's allergic to cigarettes, bad idea, let me tell you, prior to everybody going smokeless in terms of the clubs and stuff. Oh, my Lord, I used to have a problem. Lee! Anyway, I'm very quick to point out that cigarettes kill a lot more people than pot or meth or any of the drugs ever did. They're just really nasty. Over something like 20, I don't have the current data, but the last time I looked, which was like 10 years ago, it was like 2,100 or 2,200 people a day from nicotine-related causes. So that's a boatload of people, and that thing has only gone up, I can guarantee. I'd be shocked if that number's gone down any. So cigarettes cause a lot more death than everything else. Now, that doesn't mean that other drugs are okay. Please don't mishear me. I'm not justifying any of that stuff because, you know, I'm a guy that doesn't do drugs, with the exception of occasional theophylline and tea. I don't always drink so-called, quote-unquote, decaffeinated tea. Tea really doesn't have caffeine. It has theophylline in it predominantly. But so-called decaffeinated tea, I don't always drink decaffeinated tea, but I most of the time do. I don't always drink decaffeinated coffee, but I do most of the time. Okay, so let's be honest. I do use, quote-unquote, psychoactive substances in the form of caffeine and theophylline, right? And I do occasionally drink alcohol, but I've never been drunk. And I've never been stoned or tried drugs or anything else because, as I tell most of my drug addicts and substance abusers, I'm crazy enough without that shit. I don't need any help. Okay? Thank you very much. Next, I can be as weird as I want to be without that crap and don't need any help. And if you who know me know that's true. Okay? So there it is. Whoop! There it is. You heard it here first. So, you know, people will often say, well, you know, so if your body's clean and sober from an addiction, physiological addiction point, now, obviously, you know, some drugs are kept in the body, in some of the fat cells and that sort of thing for up to 2 years, but they don't have a significant impact in your performance and they won't lead to, you know, craving kind of dillies going back, you know, from 2 years. So if that's the case, why do people relapse on drugs and alcohol? Well, as I mentioned earlier, it's because of the psychological issues, not because of the physical issues. All right? So this is a psychological problem, not a physical problem. Right? So the trick is to sort of rewire the thought process in the brain so that you're not going back to using drugs. Also, as I mentioned earlier, there's an association learning effect, what's known in the psychological literature as classical conditioning, also known as Pavlovian conditioning, after Ivan Pavlov, who is the Russian canine psychophysicist, gastroenterology guy, who actually won his Nobel Peace Prize back in the day for his work with canines and their GI systems, their gastrointestinal systems. In fact, Ivan Pavlov's big claim to fame prior to him being known for his work with conditioning dogs was in the area of getting animals to take a cannula tube without anesthesia. Now, for those of you who don't know what a cannula tube is, and I suspect that's the vast majority of you out there, I wouldn't know it either if I didn't know the story, so, you know, don't feel badly here. The cannula tube is that really long needle thingy that they stick in the dog's mouth in order to collect saliva vis-a-vis a tube that goes in a jar. So when you're doing experiments on dogs back in the day, you would have these needles that would go in. They had little holes in them, obviously, and the saliva would come through the needle into the tube down into the jar. And that's how they could tell the dog was salivating. So one day, Pavlov goes into the lab and to feed the dogs, and he's got, you know, the dog food and the dog starts salivating. They haven't even put the food down, and Pavlov goes, wow, that's kind of cool. The dogs know they're getting food. And he tries this a couple of times and goes, hey, that's kind of cool. I wonder if I can use that behavior response, that unconditioned behavior response, right, to get them to salivate to something else. So I can condition, quote unquote, think of that as training or learning. Conditioning is just another word for learned behavior, or conditioning, learning, training, same deal. Okay? So don't be impressed with all these technical terms. That's your other takeaway lesson for today. So Pavlov starts pairing or associating the sound of this bell with showing the dogs his food. And pretty soon, all he has to do, as most of you know the story, is he, you know, rings the bells and the dogs start salivating. They don't have to see the meat powder or the food. They just start salivating. So he's conditioned or trained the dogs or taught the dogs to salivate to the sound of the bell. Right? That's the same phenomena that when your cat or dog learns, you know, when you, if you feed them with dry cat food or dry dog food, your dog, obviously, not your cat, hopefully, unless you have a very weird cat, although I didn't know, had friends whose cats like dog food, so, you know, what do I know? Anyway, where, you know, the cat gets used to you the sound of the dry cat food shaking in the box, pouring in the cat bowl, so if you want the cat to come, you know, here, kitty, 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 and the cat's like, screw you, honey, I'm not coming, right? Any of you who have cats know what I'm talking about. It's a real interesting phenomenon. All you do is take the box out and start shaking them, and the cats are like, oh, food? Okay, that's a different story. I'm coming. Right? So what's happened is that's Pavlovian conditioning. Well, boys and girls, ladies and gents, people are subject to that too, obviously. And if you don't believe me, you can look at a bunch of studies. That's how most of the fear responses we have are conditioned, by the way. These kind of so-called irrational fears, these phobias, that's what phobia means, irrational fear. That's how they're learned. We don't come out of the chute with them, okay? We have to learn that they're dangerous. So most phobias are learned, and they're learned through classical conditioning paradigms usually, right? Also known, as I said, as Pavlovian conditioning. So what happens is, in the case of addictive behavior, you associate certain things. So you associate certain people with smoking cigarettes, or certain areas of town with getting drugs, or certain situations like before or after sex, let's say. I know I said the S word. Or, you know, if you're smoking cigarettes after a meal, or when you get up in the morning, or when you before you go to bed tonight, or whatever. So you associate certain activities or certain settings or certain people with substance use. And so the trick becomes to try to eliminate some of that stuff so that you break the association between using the substance and the event, person, or place, which is why you'll see in AA's so-called Big Book, for those of you who don't know, that stands for Alcoholic Anonymous, the 12-step organization, and the Big Book is like their Bible, so to speak, of little sayings and stuff. I'm going to get to that in a later episode. But while I'm not a in any way, shape, or form a disease model person, I'm probably the antithesis of the disease model and probably their, one of their greatest opponents to the disease model. It doesn't work. It never did work. And we've known that for 50-plus years, but we keep using it in this country because, in my personal opinion, this is just an opinion, so please don't pull out the stone tablets. We're just voicing opinions here. It's because we're Americans, and Americans like other people to blame for their stuff. They don't like taking responsibility for their stuff, so they want to blame God or, you know, disease or whatever. And the reality is we choose to use, period, end of story. And I'm going to go into this in much greater detail in a later podcast. This is not the time for that. So, but one of the things that the 12-step Big Book says, and I'm in complete agreement with this, is that, you know, it says you want to avoid people, places, and things that encourage you to use. What they're talking about is classical conditioning, associative learning, right? Which is why parole officers or probation officers, when they, you know, counsel with their, you know, felons or, you know, whatever, they'll say you can't associate with other criminal, former criminals or, you know, whatever. That's part of that deal, is they're trying to reduce temptation to engage in criminal activity so that you end up back in jail. Do not pass go, do not collect $200, right? The same scenario applies to drugs. And that's why you quit smoking and drinking at the same time. And if you know anything about the famous study that was done, I think back in the late 70s, by the American Medical Association, JAMA, the Journal of the American Medical Association, that's the abbreviation for it, looked at a study that was done with a bunch of physicians who were alcoholics and cigaretteaholics, if you will. And about half the guys in the group decided they were going to quit both at the same time, and the other half went, there's no freaking way I'm quitting cigarettes. I'll stop drinking, obviously, but I'm not going to quit cigarettes. Well, guess what happened? That's right. The group that stopped both remained abstinent at a much, much, much higher rate than the group that didn't. And in fact, you are 10 times more likely to relapse in the first 2 years if you continue to smoke cigarettes and drink alcohol, and you only stop the alcohol, but you don't stop the cigarettes. You're 10 times more likely to relapse than if you stop both at the same time. Now, is it a whole lot more emotionally, psychologically, and physically painful the first 3 to 6 months? You bet your bippy it is. By the way, in case most of you don't know or didn't know this, and you probably don't even know who this is, but your parents know who this is, the Marlboro Man, the guy that used to do all the Marlboro commercials, died. Okay, guess what he died of? That's right. Lung cancer. Why? Because the son of a biscuit eater smoked cigarettes. Marlboro cigarettes. Anyway, just an aside there. So when addicts tell me, oh, I'm not, yeah, you are. You're stopping both. If you want to continue to be drug-free, you really need to stop both. And besides, cigarettes will kill you a lot worse than that alcohol will, right? The problem is, of course, the cigarettes take a lot longer to kill you. Usually, you see the negative impact of the alcohol a lot quicker than you see the negative impact of cigarettes. They sort of lull you into the sense of false security. So, at any rate, I wanted to say that because it's real important, because the classical conditioning thing is very, very prevalent. So, somebody who just quits drinking, they keep smoking, and then they go, well, gee, you know, a beer would grow great with this cigarette, or, you know, a Mai Tai or a Tom Collins or whatever the heck they're drinking would go great with a cigarette. Oh, one won't hurt me. Yeah, right. So, you know, therein lies the conundrum, and there lies the problem. So, you know, most people can't just quit it one drink, particularly if they've crossed the line from substance abuse to substance dependency. Although there is a pretty prevalent body of data, and we've known about this for a long time too, by the way, boys and girls, ladies and gentlemen, that there are a pretty substantial group of people, I don't remember the exact percentage, but something like 43 or 47% of folks who've been diagnosed as addicts, quote-unquote, who can go back to using drugs and not relapse into full addiction. They can use drugs recreationally and not become addicts. Okay, and we validate that. That's been a well known study, and yet we still want to say, you know, part of the thing that the AA says, oh, you know, you can't stop, it'll kill you, you can't go back. Well, that's not true. You can, but here's the kicker: only about 43 to 47%. I think it's 47, but whatever. Can go back to recreationally using substances and not relapse back into their old ways. However, that still leaves, least we forget, that still leaves 53%+ of the people who can't, right? And so my advice to most people who are trying to become, you know, clean and sober, so to speak, is that they do just that. They become clean and sober. They don't go back and tempt fate. Bad, 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 bad. Did I mention bad? Bad idea. Especially if you're one of these folks that has a lot of comorbid psychological conditions that often makes it harder to stick with stuff that you agree to do with yourself, right? So we already know, for example, that certain disorders have a higher proclivity towards using substances to moderate their mood. Right, ADHD being one of them, schizophrenics being one of them, certainly bipolars, conduct disordered folks, certain personality disorders, particularly the cluster Bs, the bad kind ones, the antisocials, the histrionics, the narcissists, and the borderlines, yes, the nasty B word, they're a lot harder to resist not falling back into the trap of addiction if they've once been an addict and now they're trying to go back and recreationally use. Probably not a really good idea. Also, if you're one of those really chronic endogenous, that's just another term for internally based or genetically based depression cases, which are fairly few, but they still exist in our society. or if you're one of those people that has a proclivity towards anxiety disorders, and let's at least we forget post-traumatic stress disorder, PTSD, falls under the anxiety disorder umbrella. So if you have one of those things, those folks have a harder time moderating their substance use once they cross the line as well. So if you're one of those folks, and you know, again, rule of thumb is if you have more than one of those disorders simultaneously, which most of my population do, your best bet is to do what the disease model says, which is become abstinent. Don't tempt fate. Another thing that the so-called disease model and I agree on. We don't agree on a lot of things, but that's definitely something that I advocate with folks. I know that's not always realistic, but it is certainly the desired outcome, particularly if you have one or more of the aforementioned disorders. It's just not a really good idea. Also, particularly if you have more than one substance dependency disorder or substance abuse disorder, which again, most people do. You know, back in the day, we used to think, oh, if you're an alcoholic, you know, you hear the term drug of choice, right? And so certainly people do have drug of choice, and usually what they have is drug class of choice. So for those of you who are not familiar with that term, what's meant by that is drugs fall under various classes according to their biochemical sites of action and or their effects on the body. So there are drugs that kind of anesthetize you and slow you down, so-called CNS depressants, central nervous system depressants, those things that slow you down, like alcohol, for example. And then you have those things which kind of space you out and make you into la-la land, so-called hallucinogens, which, by the way, folks, pot, marijuana, right, cannabis is a hallucinogen. It is not a mellow drug. And I know most of you guys and gals out there who are pot smokers go, dude, I get mellow when I smoke pot. I mean, totally. Yeah, I know you do. But what is the psychoactive ingredient in cannabis? Yes, we're back to Final Jeopardy again. Well, in case you didn't get that right, it's tetranine delta hydrocannabinol. Right, THC. What is THC? Ding, 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 that's right, it's a hallucinogen. Now, I grant you, marijuana, unless you get the really high dosage levels like the Sensimilla or some of the artificially genetically altered forms of marijuana, they're pretty, you know, they're not as good hallucinogens as, let's say, you know, LSD or peyote or mescaline or any of that kind of stuff. Granted, no argument there at all. But think of the quote-unquote hallucinogenic properties as the spacing out properties, the so-called dissociation. By the way, folks, there's no extra A in that word. It's not disassociation. The word is dissociation, okay? Dissociation, not disassociation. So please, if you're one of those people that says that's one of my big pet peeves, please stop saying that. It's inaccurate. There's no such word as disassociation. It's dissociation. And that's a technical term, which means your mind and your body are walking along two different paths at the same time. Kind of like you do when you're having a dream or a nightmare, or when you're hypnotizing yourself or in meditation or whatever. Those are all states, any trance state, that's a state of dissociation, okay? So what pot does more than anything is you get the sense of dissociation. You know, you start to lose sense of your body and you start to become kind of semi-anesthetized in the you don't, you know, you're not as aware of your anxieties and stuff. And so it feels like you're not in touch with stuff. And it feels like you're, quote unquote, mellowing out. But you're really not. It's a form of, it's a weak-ass form of hallucination, in a sense, if you want to think it that way. It's definitely dissociation. So anyway, pot's a hallucinogenic drug. It's not a mellow drug. It's not a sedative, okay? So drugs are classed according to their psychoactive properties. unfortunately, what happens is certain disorders tend to like to have as their quote-unquote drug of choice, drug class of choice, I should say, because that's much more accurate, actually. Although some people do have a specific drug they prefer, like alcohol or marijuana or cocaine or whatever. If you think of drug class of choice, drugs of choice like central nervous system depressants, like alcohol, for example, Quaaludes are obviously sedative hypnotics, any of that kind of stuff. Sleeping pills have sedative hypnotics. Methquaalones, Quaaludes, barbiturates, which you probably know as barbiturates, but they come from the barbiturate plant, so I call them barbiturates. Any of the benzodiazepines, so-called benzos, right, which are the drugs that replaced the barbiturates, as you would call it, for anxiety, those are all, you know, slow-down drugs. They're all CNS depressant drugs. So usually if you see people who have a preference for a CNS depressant, they're going to pick one of those drugs, right? So unfortunately what happens is people with the disorders usually pick the drug that's the last drug they ought to be taking, okay? So for example, what I mean by that is, a great example of that is depression. So folks who have depressive disorders, whether it's dysthymic disorder, which is a chronic sort of low-level form of, as I like to refer to it, wimpy depression. It's a depression that doesn't quite meet the depression criteria. It's called dysthymic disorder. Folks who have major depression or dysthymic disorder often like alcohol. And that's the last doggone drug they ought to be doing, because that's the thing that's going to make them even more depressed, because it's a central nervous depressant. That's right. Hey, likewise, you'll see people who are ADHD, one of their favorite drugs class of choice are hallucinogens, and their favorite drug, hallucinogenic drug of choice is often marijuana. Well, why is that a bad idea? Well, they're already having brain farts, as I call it, OBF, organic brain farts, thinking cognitive processing problems with the ADHD, and usually that involves memory issues, and most ADHD people aren't very motivated to do stuff they don't want to do, right? So-called amotivational syndrome. Well, what are the two side effects from chronic pot use? That's right, amotivational syndrome. You don't want to do shit, especially the stuff that you're supposed to do that you don't want to do. You're like even less motivated to do it. And one of the other side effects of chronic pot use is, that's right, memory problems. So that's the last freaking drug ADHD people ought to do, yet it's usually the first drug they go for. So that's what I talk about, is that people with certain disorders tend to go for the drug that's the worst for them. I'm just like, okay, could you please do something helpful? Okay, if you're going to do a drug, do something helpful, you know, an illicit drug, obviously. So most people who can't get their quote-unquote drug or drug class of choice, even if they have a drug of choice, they can't get that one. They'll usually go to one in the same drug class. So if they can't get alcohol, they'll get something else that's a CNS depressant. But, you know, most people are equal opportunity drug abusers. If they can't get one drug, they'll go for, you know, what's their next favorite drug? Well, I'll go for that one, right? So what you've seen over the years is, prior to probably the 70s or 80s, certainly prior to the 80s, everybody thought, well, if you're an alcoholic, you're an alcoholic, and, you know. And then we found out about this thing called cross-addiction, which means if you're addicted to one drug, like a CNS depressant drug, like Quaaludes, for example, you're probably going to become more easily addicted to other central nervous system depressants like alcohol. So, okay, oh. But if you really looked at people, what happened back in the day is folks were treated just for the one drug that was their predominant drug or drug of choice, or in the drug class of choice even. So they'd go out and stop, you know, they'd go to AA and quit drinking, or they'd go to therapy or whatever and quit drinking, and then they'd go out and, you know, do other forms of drugs. And like, well, you know, I'm not a pot, I don't have addiction to pot, I'll smoke pot. It's, you know, whatever. I really like cocaine, so pot's really not a CNS activator drug, an exciter drug like cocaine is, so I'll just smoke pot. Well, you can't do that either, okay? Because, you know, what happens is you get out of your mind, so to speak. The drug lowers your inhibitions, as all drugs do that. Some drugs also make you paranoid, but that's another issue. So, you know, what happens is you use a drug for a while, and then you go, well, shit, it won't hurt me if I just go and do this other drug. I know I'm not supposed to, but just one. Yeah, right. Okay, so you guys get where this is going. So in the long run, particularly if you have previous attempts at stopping, multiple attempts at stopping or cutting back, and you've been, like, horribly unsuccessful to try to use a drug, and you've been horribly unsuccessful in, you know, moderating your use, or you have one or more of the aforementioned disorders that often have substance use and abuse disorders as part of their, you know, syndrome, you probably don't want to do that stuff. And that's why I tell everybody, if you have a drug addiction problem, a dependency problem, your best bet is abstinence, right? And it's sad but true. Your best, you know, life position is abstinence. However you can do that, okay? So that's sort of our introductory, if you will, lecture to substance use disorders. So I hated to get all technical on you today, but I wanted to give you a background because the next couple of podcasts we're going to talk about are going to be what do you do, how these things are manifested, what are some tactics you can use that are both 12-step model based, if you're into that, or non-traditional so-called alternative methods of treatment and what you can do with that. And if you also have a psych disorder, what do you do if you have a psych disorder that requires medication? Do you just not take medications? Because back in the old day, that was considered a relapse and is still considered a relapse by some hardcore 12-step programs. And you don't even want me to go there. So I hope that that has helped folks get a little bit of a handle on this issue of substance use disorders and the difference in use, abuse, and dependency. And what we're going to be doing in follow-up sessions of these podcasts is exploring more in depth about addictions, because obviously these are something that are not going away and really have a huge impact in terms of lethality, both from the drugs themselves and in terms of most suicides and homicides. You'll see a lot of violent crimes committed under the influence, and drinking and driving, obviously, which sometimes leads to fatalities and all sorts of negative consequences. So substances are, in general, not a great thing to become using on a regular basis, and in some cases even on one basis. So we're going to be talking about that in more depth in the upcoming podcast. Hope you enjoyed it. I hope it wasn't too verbose for you, and I look forward to seeing everybody soon. Thanks for listening. Talk to you later.